Coming up on Central Standard, a look at ways clergy are working to make our metro healthier. I'll be joined in the first half of the show by two local clergymen from different faith communities discussing their role in restoring economic dignity to the Kansas City metro area. And a guest, a Reverend DeForest Sorries, who preaches the gospel of personal financial responsibility. He's devoted his life to helping African Americans achieve spiritual growth, educational excellence, and economic empowerment. Plus, in the second half of our program, a look at an initiative that Cerner is offering to provide free health screenings to area children. I'm Jabulani LaFall. We'll hear some of Cerner's findings and how the program is being implemented into area schools. That's ahead on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. The Valley of the Dry Bones is an often told sermon from the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament, dealing with the redemption and resurrection of a dead and vanquished people. This week, more than 75 local faith and community leaders representing a diverse cross-section of religious, racial, and socioeconomic backgrounds have literally taken a page out of that book of Ezekiel. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. And joining us now are the Reverend Dr. DeForest Sorries, acclaimed author, advocate, and former New Jersey Secretary of State, Reverend Jennifer Thomas of the Emmanuel Lutheran Church, and Reverend Wallace Hartsfield II from the Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church to talk about a different type of resurrection, one involving economic dignity. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Now, last night you held an event titled The Ezekiel Revival that dealt with more secular issues, payday loans and raising the minimum wage. Tell us, Reverend Sorries, about some of the things that were discussed and the overall goal of this program.
Well, thank you for having us, and I'm happy to be in Missouri. What you describe as secular for us is also quite spiritual, because the souls of our people are directly related to the quality or lack thereof of their lives. This economic dignity campaign, therefore, that's focusing now on payday loans and on minimum wage, seeks to bring the Judeo-Christian values that were the foundation of this country to bear on this very urgent crisis. Payday lending is what I call the crack cocaine of predatory financial practices. And we believe that many families will be rescued, many homes will be salvaged, many lives will be better if we're able to put a cap on the payday lending industry and if we're able to raise the minimum wage.
Reverend Hartsfield, out of all the biblical allusions to draw from, why Ezekiel? Why was Ezekiel the source of this particular revival as a springboard to the events that are going to happen later today?
Well, little over a year ago, Pastor Hartsfield Sr., which is my father, actually addressed a group that was developing around various issues just like this, and he made use of what is considered to be a very familiar text within the context of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and really not just limited to the Judeo-Christian tradition. Many persons know about the dry bones, as per se. I think this becomes an intriguing text to deal with, because it's not only because there's a valley here with dry bones. There is this whole ideal that when the prophet is asked, can these bones live, the prophet returns back to trust in God, you know, Lord. And then there's the proceeding forward with speaking to the bones. I think the challenge that comes to all of us right now is, what do you actually address the bones with? Yes, we can say in general the word of the Lord, but what is the word of the Lord in this time and place? We believe one of those things right now is to confront industries that dehumanize people. That's the word of the Lord that confronts the dehumanization of persons, especially through economic means in which people are made to feel less than human.
So economic disparity,
yes,
is the bones in this case.
Well, economic disparity is the is the word that one needs to confront an industry like the payday industry with. That is, the practices that you are engaged in are irresponsible because they lead to, one, economic incarceration, two, you're targeting specifically vulnerable people, communities that are predominantly minority and the working poor, and you are intentionally going after them because you know that they have no other place to turn.
Let's bring in Reverend Jennifer Thomas of the Emmanuel Lutheran Church. How did you get involved, and how did all the clergy of the KC Metro area come together around this initiative?
Congregation-based organizing in Kansas City is done with one-to-one conversation and relationship building. And because of relationships with one another across those things that we might initially think divide us, we find that we have things in common with one another. And it's through communities creating opportunity first that I got involved in the work, coming from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I'd been engaged in congregation-based organizing earlier, knowing that as a faith community, it's one of the most effective ways that we can confront economic injustice in our community, and that we stand together with everyone in our community for economic dignity.
Had you, Reverend Thomas, or you, Reverend Hartsfield, been involved in previous economic justice issues or protests or initiatives or ministries before this, and how did that inform what you're doing now?
Well, economics is at the heart of where I pastor, in the neighborhood that I pastor, especially being within the context of the third district and so forth. There are many different economic issues. So this was just an additional one, but one that really contributes in a major way to the siphoning, to developing that of a permanent underclass. Some of the other economic issues would have dealt with just community disinvestment in general, has happened, whether that happened first with white flight, then followed by black flight, and everybody's looking for a ticket out of the community where I pastor, and that's because of the economics not being there.
What does economic justice look like, Reverend Dr. Soares, and what are some steps to get there?
Well, that's a great question, because this issue of economic disparity is directly related to economic injustice. It's not that people are poor because they want to be poor or because they're lazy. We have economic systems that make it easier for some and harder for others. Easier includes access. Easier includes regulations. Easier includes relationships. And so economic justice campaigns like these seek to do a few things. One, to educate people about their options. That's a part of the campaign. Economic justice movements include pressing policymakers for policies that are fair. The payday lending industry, for instance, is underregulated. There was a time in this state where there were usury laws that would make it impossible to have the kind of payday stores that you have here. Economic justice includes creating alternatives. The credit union movement, for instance, is a part of the economic justice movement, where you have alternative products that are affordable and accessible to all people. And then economic injustice in this regard also involves direct action, where you actually confront the powers that perpetrate schemes of injustice to bring attention to those schemes and to educate people about the nature of those schemes, and then to invite those people to consider changing their ways. And so a movement of economic justice includes all of those components.
Reverend Hartsfield, you've taken an issue with the word faith-based as sort of a buzzword to encompass so many complex things. How do you bring together faith versus economic justice when traditionally the church had been involved in issues of social justice or gender inequality or racial inequality? How does this economic piece fit in, and what approach do you take?
Once again, It's about the humanity of a person, anything that's connected with that, economics, race, whether we deal with other class issues, gender, sexuality, it doesn't make a difference. The church cannot afford to sit by and not address things that are a part of people's humanity. All right. At any point that the church or any other faith tradition is quiet when people's humanity is threatened, that's the time that we need to question whether or not that tradition is still relevant or not.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR on your FM dial, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're talking about a rallying cry for economic justice with the Reverend Dr. DeForest Sorries, an acclaimed author, advocate, and former New Jersey Secretary of State, Reverend Jennifer Thomas of the Emmanuel Lutheran Church, and Reverend Wallace Hartsfield II from the Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church here in Kansas City. Kansas City, what does economic justice look like to you? What are some of the biggest problems you see KC facing today in that regard? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up via email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and you can tweet at KCURCST. Once again, to join the conversation, 816-235-2888. Reverend Thomas, can you tell us about the Cap the Rate, Raise the Wage ballot initiatives that this program is a part of?
The first one, Capping the Rate, is to bring the average and cap for the loans to a 36% APR. Right now in Missouri, it's $1,900 as a cap, and the average is over 400%.
$1,900 is a cap, and 400% APR?
Yes, is the average that people are paying.
And you're probably trying to bring it down to 36.
We are. And we have been working for over 13 years in Missouri with the legislature, and we've decided that that particular strategy hasn't worked, and we're taking it to the voters with a ballot initiative. We're working with other organizations across the state, and in relationship with them, have taken on a second ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage in Missouri to meet the federal guidelines, which would move it from $7.25 an hour to $8.25. And what that means is that people who are working a minimum wage job in our community are earning $290 a week, and that is not enough to make ends meet.
And Reverend Hartsfield, how do these issues, cap the rate, raise the wage, go hand in hand?
Well, one, it doesn't allow this industry to engage in practices that are intended to trap persons, that is, by presenting the whole notion of a short-term loan, but the backside of that is a short-term loan with long-term debt, because in most instances, many of the persons who take these loans are already hard-pressed financially. They are unable to pay back these loans in a couple of weeks. Therefore, the average now is that persons are going through eight cycles at least before they're able to pay it back. So this capping the rate would keep the compounding from taking place with regard to what persons are paying interest-wise. Obviously, raising the wage is that one of the reasons why persons are having to take out these loans and make these loans a way of life is because they do not make enough money to make ends meet.
We're talking about economic justice, economic disparities, and economic dignity with several members of the clergy here, Reverend DeForest Sorries, former New Jersey Secretary of State, Wallace Hartsfield II from the Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church, and Jennifer Thomas of the Emmanuel Lutheran Church, 816-235-2888, if you'd like to join the conversation. Adam from Shawnee, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having me on, Jabalani. My question for the panel is fairly simple. I wonder if an internal eye is ever used on the church. I know that there was a report that came out about 3 years ago that showed, at least in the United States, that only about 2 to 3% of money brought in from tithes and offerings to churches go directly back to the community or to charity in direct form, and the rest is simply used for administrative costs and building and functions of that nature. And I just think as long as we're talking about being righteous and proper with the money brought in through institutions and organizations and a government standpoint, do you think that there should be a call upon the church to spend more of its money in direct aid to the community?
That's a good question, loosely based on the conversation, but relevant nonetheless. Reverend Hartsfield, would you like to be the first to address that?
Well, absolutely. I think that churches should be taken to task just as much as any other industry when people are exploited, when people are dehumanized. I think it we run dangerously close sometimes to just making a general statement and painting with a large paintbrush to suggest that administrative costs that may go towards personnel is not something that is intended to lead towards serving and the building up of people, the putting in place of ministry programs and so forth, just to suggest that these things are just administrative infrastructure that does not lead to the edification of persons. I would question whether or not we just need to make that general statement, but I go along with the tenor of the statement that the church needs to be called into question, too, when it exploits.
Speaking of being called into question and responsibility, Reverend Soares, you espouse what you call a gospel of personal financial responsibility. Tell us about that.
Well, first, I agree with Pastor Hartsfield that churches should and are held accountable. We're tax exempt. We are regulated by government. We are subject to audits. We file 990s, and churches that are beyond the mainstream should be held accountable not only by government but by their own members. And that's a part of this personal responsibility. I report to my church members on every penny that the church spends. We present a budget to the church, and the church votes on the budget. We're accountable to our membership. And we ask our members to be accountable in the way they spend their money. I got a call from the NFL that asked me to come speak to people who are professional football players because the average NFL player, by the time he finishes his career, is broke. And so some of what we have to do, Pastor Hartsfield referred to earlier, that is teach people how to prioritize, how to budget, how to invest, how to save, how to purchase insurance. We had in my church a woman who was losing her home, and as we attempted to help her renegotiate with the bank, we discovered she was spending $250 a month on pay-per-view. That may not have been precisely the most important thing she could do with the funds. And so it's a balance. We both have to fight for justice and for responsibility.
Reverend Thomas, where does personal responsibility and what you teach at your church come into this discussion about payday loans and economic dignity that can be fostered on an individual basis?
Well, this gets tricky. We use church language like building up disciples and whole life stewardship, and we encourage people to share out of the gifts that God has given them with their community and understand that all of our life is a gift from God and that it should be used to glorify God and to help others. One of our primary commandments that we share with a lot of faith traditions is to love God and our neighbor as ourselves. And so what we need to be thinking about is how we're using what we own to not only benefit ourselves, but how it impacts and benefits our neighbors. And that's why I'm involved as a religious leader in congregation-based organizing and in this fight for economic dignity, because I understand that what happens to my neighbor is directly involved in my life, that our destinies are intertwined. And what happens in the inner city in a metropolitan place like Kansas City has a direct impact on the suburbs.
I'm going to go to Oliver in Lawrence. Oliver, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks. I was just calling because a couple of years ago, I became aware of a group of investors who were trying to establish a fund, an alternative to payday loans, and the objective, the objective was to get ethically minded investors to invest in this large fund, which would then try to manage payday type loans in a more reasonable way with reasonable interest rates. And the problem that those things ran into, ran across was that they were deemed securities, and the securities commissioners in various states said they needed to study them. So I don't know what's become of these things. But if people who are interested in counteracting the negative effects of payday loan institutions were to contact the Kansas State Securities Commission, they might find out that there is some progress being made.
Securitization is also a problem that lent in large part to the subprime crisis that we had. Is there any talk about, rather than vilifying payday loans, or in tandem with vilifying payday loans, is there any talk about the alternatives, addressing the underbanked issue in these impoverished communities?
Sure, that's a huge issue. And, for instance, the National Association of Community Development Credit Unions, which we're a member of, has developed specific products and strategies as templates for community-based organizations, for CDFIs, community development financial institutions, to offer specific alternative products to people who are underbanked and people who are unbanked.
What are some of those alternative products, just to get a sample of what those are?
Well, they're essentially accessible, low-interest, short-term loans that come with an accompanying financial literacy package so that people are not only borrowing, it's kind of like the micro-lending model that happens throughout developing countries. And people, we do it in New Jersey through our Community Development Credit Union. And so there is a growing interest in the credit union community to offer these low-interest, short-term loans that are accompanied by financial literacy and personal empowerment.
And a couple of things I just say on that real quickly is that the group, one of the groups, the organizing groups here in the city, has actually put together a Community Fair Lending Act, which is based upon the 36% interest that we're asking that the rate be capped at, and trying to get faith institutions involved and prepared to be able to administer those funds. Let me also say no one here is necessarily saying that we're trying to put payday lending out of business. What we're saying is that free enterprise cannot be done devoid of social responsibility. There has to be a moral link between free enterprise and social responsibility.
Justin in Raytown, welcome to Central Standard.
Well, yeah, I was just curious about why there is such a focus on payday loans when there's a lot of institutions that profit in ways that individuals may not exactly agree with, and I believe that would probably be their freedom, kind of like casinos or liquor stores or head shops or bars or strip clubs or whatever. And I guess I wanted to note, I grew up in wholesale jewelry. We would sell a product to a retail store that would immediately mark it up at least 400 to 1,000%. And I'm sure there's a lot of businesses who mark up their product. And I guess if you look at lending money as a product, what would differentiate between a lending institution charging a price for the product and anybody else? If you borrowed a drill from Lowe's for 2 weeks or whatever, how much would you expect to pay for that if the drill is worth $300 or whatever? I'm just trying to equate this to other businesses and how you can tell one business that can practice a certain way when it's practicing like every other business, it seems like.
Thank you, Justin, for your thoughts. This is an interesting thought, but it's really about the quick cash culture that pervades impoverished communities.
It's about the quick cash culture. It's about people who are in dire economic straits being targeted for high cost products. It's about the proliferation of these products in certain neighborhoods. It is true that we live, as Pastor Hartsfield said, in a free market economy, but it's also true that government has a responsibility to regulate businesses to ensure fairness. It's also true that the faith community has the obligation of empowering people. The people in my congregation put money in the place every Sunday, and that keeps our business going. I feel some sense of obligation to help them understand their options and to teach them what is a good option versus a bad option. I heard Pastor Hartsfield say something last night that was quite meaningful, and that is, because we want two-parent homes doesn't mean that we promote having bad fathers stay in the home. Because we like free enterprise doesn't mean that we promote businesses that are unscrupulous in their practices. Now, this is not the only unscrupulous business, and to that end, I agree with the caller completely. But this is the tip of the economic iceberg. This is the poster child of what's wrong in this economic system. And we feel that since there used to be laws to limit people in terms of how much they can charge, we think that the reinstatement of laws that put caps on this kind of business is appropriate.
Reverend Hartsfield, are payday loans the tip of the iceberg, the poster child, the perfect institutional framework to go after in this case of economic injustice, as opposed to a casino or as opposed to one of the other institutions?
Well, that's a hard question there, because I believe all of them need to be taken to task. I just believe that because of how fast this industry has grown over the last 20 years, as we say, this becomes one of the most gross representations of what happens when the working poor, and that's an issue that nobody, for whatever reason, will bring up, is that this is an issue really that's really just an outgrowth of contributing to the cycle of poverty. All right, this targets working poor people. And for whatever reason, in our nation, we are more and more talking more about middle class and the upper class rich, and no one will talk about the poor. Capitalism, some of the founders of capitalism would say that when you have concentrations of wealth, it's also important at that time that you have to extend the safety net for the poor. And that's what we're seeking to do here.
If I could add something, I would add that we determine what the issues will be in faith-based organizing through relationships and listening sessions. And we ask a very critical question of everyone that we are in relationship with: what keeps you awake at night? And for people living in our communities, not being able to make ends meet, not being able to provide for their families, not being able to repay their large debts, being caught in debt traps, is what are keeping people in our faith communities awake at night. And that's why we've chosen this particular issue.
And speaking of which, Reverend Hartwell, today at 1 p.m., you'll be gathering at a site, according to events materials, that evokes the economic injustice that afflicts our communities. That site is 39th and Truce. Tell us why the group chose that particular intersection, and then tell us what will take place there.
39th and Truce or 40th and Main? All right, 40th and Main. We're going to be at 40th and Main on today. All right, and
pretty close.
Yeah, pretty close. Yeah, we felt like this would be a good place. It becomes a pretty neutral place in the sense that it really represents a couple of things. It's close enough to the east side where you have the most concentration of these payday lenders, but also it suggests the notion that, you know what, payday lending is not just on the east side of Truce. Payday lending is everywhere, and ultimately impacting this permanent underclass that is being created. So we will be there at 40th and Main on today as a representation of fighting for the economic dignity of all.
So as this ballot initiative moves forward, Jennifer Thomas, what's the next step after that?
We'll continue to listen to our community and determine what keeps people awake at night, continue to chip away at that iceberg that Reverend Soares mentioned earlier. This is one way that the economic dignity and the human dignity of people in our community is being affected, but there are many other ways, and we're going to work together as a faith community made up of diverse denominations and faith backgrounds, working together for a unified Kansas City where everyone is entitled to a healthy lifestyle.
We've been talking about economic justice and economic dignity with our guest, Reverend Dr. DeForest Sorey. He's an acclaimed author, community advocate, and former New Jersey Secretary of State. We also had Reverend Jennifer Thomas of the Emmanuel Lutheran Church and Reverend Wallace Hartsfield II from the Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church. They'll be part of an event taking place today at 1 p.m. on 40th and Main. Thank you for coming on Central Standard today.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll be discussing another initiative to empower people through healthcare. We'll chat about a program at Cerner fostering free health screenings for children. More on that when we return. And welcome back to Central Standard. When you watch a medical drama emergency scene, the word stat is used a lot. It comes from a Latin term statum, meaning immediately, and is also used as an acronym for sooner than already there. In this part of the hour, we discuss the term stat as it relates to alarming statistics about children's obesity and health problems and provide the basis for preventative health care goals. Joining us now are Melissa Fraking, Executive Director of the First Hand Foundation, and Anna Hens, Program Director of the First Hand Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. We wanted to say thanks for letting us be here. And in order to get a little background, I thought maybe we could quickly give you a little bit of background on First Hand. First Hand was founded back in 95 by some of the same founders as Cerner, as well as our associates. So Neil Patterson, who's Cerner's CEO, his wife, Jean Lillig Patterson, and then Cliff Illig. So we have a long history of a lot of entrepreneurial thinking around the foundation. And our core vision originally when they created it was to be able to give back in a highly impacted manner directly to individual kids who would fall through the gaps of healthcare.
How does this relate to medical statistics, such as STAT?
Well, Cerner's made their business around automating the healthcare process, and so what we find is that we're able to take a lot of clinical information for children and come up with some really creative programming to meet the needs and help identify the health concerns that they might have. And then when it comes to the STAT program, we are using that health data to educate students to make immediate lifestyle changes so that they don't end up with preventable conditions later in life.
What are some of the more urgent statistics that we see about teenage health?
Well, what we base the STAT program around are the top preventable conditions as outlined by the CDC, so things like heart disease and type 2 diabetes, along with traumatic brain injury due to texting while driving. We just see teens are engaging in a lot of habits that are not setting them up for a lifestyle of health or a lifetime of health. And so what we're doing is trying to show them the long-term ramifications of their everyday decisions. And I think if you know a teenager, you know that they think they're invisible. So we try to put a very real face on all of these conditions.
Invisible as well as invincible.
Exactly.
Speaking of which, how do you engage these students in assessing their own lifestyle choices? And more important, how do you engage parents who may have the same issues and may be passing down some of these habits? So that's a sort of two-part question, but it's connected.
It's definitely a two-part question. And what we're doing in the elementary schools is we're out doing the health screenings to identify those early issues, make a referral to get the child the care that they need. And we've been doing that for about 5 years. And then what we found was, you can make a weight referral for a child that's 6 years old and has a high BMI. But when they go home, there's nothing they can do about it because the parent is putting poor food choices in front of them. So we decided to start at the high school level with the education component because that's when they start to really make their own decisions around what they're going to eat and how active they're going to be. And it's going to set them up for that long-term health. The way that the students are interacting right now with the STAT curriculum, it's online. It's delivered in health class. The teacher teaches it. It's the same content that they would normally be getting in health class. It's just maybe a little bit more exciting because it's web-based.
So once the initial contact is made, how does this web-based program go forward? How do you get the wheels moving, so to speak?
Yeah, we offer some pretty comprehensive trainings for the high school teachers. They spend about 4 hours with us, And then we offer some on-site support as they go live with it the first time. It takes about 2 weeks in their classroom. But we find that once they've implemented it once, you know, they kind of get the gist of it and they can do it over and over again.
And I think one of the pieces that was very helpful is when we started the school screenings at the elementary level, that program's been going on for 5 years. So we got the buy-in and the trust from the teachers and the families. Tabitha Carson is our nurse that runs that program, and we have participation rates as high as 100% in some of the elementary schools. So it wasn't a new name to them.
Is it the overall goal to catch some of these kids in elementary school and then track their health issues or health progress through high school?
That would be the ultimate goal. We're not quite there yet. As we've got 5 years of screening information at the elementary level, they are growing up and will grow into the high school programming. We're still evaluating whether or not we come up with some kind of hybrid of the two for the middle school age. But our intent is that we would have a comprehensive view of a student health status from elementary school through high school as they go on into adulthood.
So you mentioned this program, this education program, takes approximately 2 weeks. That would be 5 school days each week, 10-day program as part of the STAT initiative. Tell us what happens in the progression of this 10-day program. What are these students learning?
Sure. They are getting a little bit of an overview of how healthcare is delivered. We thought it was important that they understand that, both so that they can be smart consumers of healthcare and just be aware of the complexity of healthcare when it's not just about going to the MinuteClinic or the emergency room or your primary care physician. It's about understanding who all interacts with you, who has access to your medical information, how important it is to maintain that and keep it private, as well as there's a little bit of a flavor of career exposure. That was something when we built the program that teachers told us they thought was important. So we actually have the students work as a team of healthcare providers around their patient, so they get to learn what it's like to be a medical technologist or a pharmacist or a physician or a nurse, as well as a hospital administrator. Somebody has to track the cost of all of the things that happen to their patients.
Are students in this program submitting their own personal data or user data on their health practices that you can use?
They do complete an anonymous survey both before and after the program. We have built some questions based off of the CDC's YRBSS survey that the CDC does it every other year. And so we're asking questions pertaining to their health literacy of the conditions that they're studying, as well as their health habits that might pertain to those same conditions. So, for example, if you're studying the patient that is texting while driving and has traumatic brain injury, the pre-questions are going to ask, you know, about their understanding of that medical condition as well as their personal habits of do you text while driving. And then the post-survey says, after seeing Brittany's story, will you continue to text while driving? And we're seeing that, of course, not every high school student is going to say, no, absolutely not. But we are moving the bar with some of them.
Are you seeing some positive data as far as students responding to health issues that could be detrimental to them? And if so, what are you doing with that data?
We are seeing some positive movement on those metrics. Our hope is that while it's just a 2-week program and a student can say that they will, you know, do something, they have the intention to change their habits, what we're hoping to put in place next are some programs that will allow us to engage with them longer term so that we can actually see that they do change their habits.
And at the elementary school level, obviously taking and tracking all of the data is very important to us. At the end of every school year, we sit down with each of the schools as well as the school districts and share our findings. So it's pretty interesting after 5 years of rolling out the screening program, you can actually see how the referrals for vision have decreased significantly. The referrals for hearing have decreased significantly. Obesity, you know, it's on the rise, and so one of our next focuses is trying to figure out how to even do more to really help the kids and the parents manage that.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Javelani LaFall. We're joined by Melissa Freaking and Anna Hens from the First Hand Foundation, telling us about some sobering statistics around childhood health and preventative care programs that can help, and a web course that students can take to become more aware of these health programs. What's the role, Anna, of technology in this program?
It plays a pretty integral role. We know that that's what students respond to. We're not in an age anymore where going into a classroom with a textbook and just reading through it and turning the pages, that's not how kids learn. So we've built a course, you know, setup that is very interactive. There's a lot of great pictures and, you know, words, vocabulary words, if they don't understand what they might mean, they can hover over them and see a picture and definition and sometimes a pronunciation because we're dealing with some pretty crazy medical terminology, as well as some fun games and ways to interact with a patient that might seem a little bit more real than reading a book.
Ironically enough, though, one of the statistics addressed on your statistics sheet is the amount of time kids spend sitting down at their computers. So how do you reconcile that with a program that is web-based?
That's a very good point. I believe that statistic is the time that they spend outside of school, so sitting at home watching TV and playing maybe a computer or video game. I think if they're going to be in a classroom anyways, we should engage with them, meet them where they're at. It's kind of fun, the piece that we haven't talked about yet, while it's 2 weeks in the classroom, that final day, we call it the personal application experience. And it, we invite the students to come actually up to Cerner. There's an on-site gym, and we go through some activities where they get to personally apply things that they've learned in the classroom, and that's everything from nutrition demonstrations, some physical fitness assessments, and then group exercise. And it's really kind of fun to see the kids get to choose, or the teacher gets to choose sometimes, which kind of activities they participate in. And the boot camp is very popular. We've got a commercial break fitness, so it's quick bursts of things that you can do if you can't, you know, if you can't give up the TV.
How does this program ultimately lead to identifying the children who need help the most, medical help?
You know, I'd say the elementary school screenings does a better job of actually identifying a critical clinical need. And in that, we've targeted schools that have a high free and reduced lunch rate, where we know there's an issue of access to quality medical care, and we have the commitment to follow up with that child, with that school nurse, with that family, if they don't have the resources to provide the child the care that they need. I think when it comes to the knowledge to make better choices, that kind of knows no socioeconomic status, and so our goal is to get it out there to everyone in the hopes that they can take that knowledge and apply it going forward.
Tell us more about the screenings. Are they free and how do they work?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the screenings are offered to a number of, there's over 14 school districts here in Kansas City. 42 schools are participating. We started the program 5 years ago with the commitment that we would not leave those schools until the 5 years was ended. We will continue this commitment ongoing. So our focus is to continue to fund those. We've seen about our referral rate when the kids fail a screening is about 47%, which, again, validates the fact that a lot of these kids that need help are not getting the care that they need today. We are also very committed to not just doing the screenings and identifying problems, but making sure that every child gets access to health care.
What have you found health-wise in those schools that are some of the most pervasive problems, and how have you recorded that?
We're using an in-kind contribution from Cerner, which is a Cerner technology. So we're using a solution that allows us to capture the electronic medical record. We have 100% of the school nurses now documenting in that record, and we are able to run reports that generate, you know, right now, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the obesity, you know, issue is the biggest concern. Dental is very large as well. We're making a big dent on reducing the vision and the hearing. We're finding lots of heart murmurs, as well as just lots of different types of areas.
How do these programs lead to identifying the costs of preventative care as it's administered?
Well, I think that is one area that we will be moving into going forward for those younger kids. We do ask, that's part of the high school education component with the STAT program. We provide the resources for those students to look at what it costs to be a diabetic patient, to have, you know, that particular patient has a leg ulcer and has to have their foot amputated. So what do all of these things cost a hospital stay? What does it cost, not just financially, but in quality of life? I think as far as identifying the financial contribution on our part, we have committed to providing care or providing resources to get kids what they need. But what we found is that actually a lot of the resources are already there. They just need somebody to advocate for them in connecting with them, and be that our wonderful program staff, the school nurse. You know, we've found a lot of avenues that parents just aren't aware of.
And I think that that's one of the more exciting things that we've learned from the program is that there are resources out there. I think the most valuable role we've played is an advocate in doing whatever it takes to get that resource connected with the child and the parent. And the school nurses, obviously, we are huge fans of the school nurses. They're doing an amazing job. And we also ask them to make sure that we get at least an 80% completion rate on every child that's identified as having some type of a need. Again, we don't want to stop until we get that. And what's been fascinating is over the 5 years, it's really only cost around $10,000 to be able to get glasses for kids that can't get them through the Lions Club, to get perhaps a hearing aid. Or sometimes it's as little as getting a gas card so that the parent can get the child to the doctor for that special appointment.
And why are the costs of such items coming down?
I'm not saying that the cost of the items are coming down, but what I'm saying is those resources do exist out there, whether it's through Medicaid, their existing insurance programs, or organizations like the Lions Club who focus on getting glasses and so forth. So a lot of the care for children, I think, is out there. It's just, number one, knowing that a problem exists. Many of these kids were screening, the parent had no idea that the child needed glasses. All of a sudden, we have huge success stories. There's a beautiful little girl the other day who needed glasses. Her mother didn't know it. She was having problems learning in class. We identified the need through the screening, and one of the first things she said is, "Wow, Mommy, I had no idea there were so many beautiful colors in the world." So it's those types of stories that are making it successful.
How do you make sure to follow up and make sure the kids get the proper treatment after the screenings take place?
Once again, that goes back to the fabulous work that the school nurses are doing. With all the cuts out there in the school system, the school nurses, unfortunately, like the rest of the educational system, have seen significant cuts in their staffing and so forth. So what we do by going out and working with them to provide some of the screenings, that takes away from some of the work that they would have to do previously so that they can focus on those kids that are identified as having a need.
Do you get a sense that Cerner would like to work more in the educational health field?
Absolutely. Cerner has a long history. We've always been very committed to both education and you know, health is what we're passionate about. And so what I think is fascinating, we just got back from a large conference that has some of the largest grant makers in the country, Robert Wood Johnson, a lot of those organizations. Fascinating enough, what they're all looking at in health is they know that technology is one of the key ways to make it more efficient and quality and effective. So I think we bring a lot to the table there. The school nurses, one of the things that they're asking us for is to go develop a solution for school nurses. So as the vision evolves with all of Anna's great work, with all of Tabitha's great work in the schools, we see that we will be able to have the connectivity between those school nurses, the pharmacist who's filling all the medications so we know which medications that the kids are on, as well as the provider and all the different people that are integral to quality health.
Is it fair to say that this is part altruistic and also part market research to look at changes in the healthcare business as well?
You know what? I think it's a great question, and I've actually started at Cerner over 28 years ago, and I can attest to the fact that the reason that we're doing it is very altruistic.
More on the altruistic side.
Yes, absolutely. And we're not, we haven't asked for one penny for any of the work, you know, that we're doing here. We have, once again, if you take a look at the founders and the entrepreneurs and Gene Lloyd Patterson, just like the new Sporting KC Stadium, they're innovators. Every penny that's being spent at the stadium is going back to cancer research.
But on the other hand, if this data collection is proven to improve preventative care, that is a plus.
Yes, yes, sure.
It is a plus. I don't think that it will ever move into the area of generating business or revenue for Cerner, though.
Do programs such as this change how healthcare is administered, though? Can they?
Well, I think absolutely. I think that now, like, for example, we had a meeting over at Children's Mercy the other day, and it was really exciting. We talked to them at the beginning of our program. We do some ongoing work with the programs. They do a lot of our referrals. And at the tail end of the meeting, we said, okay, well, here, after 5 years, this is kind of where we are and what we're seeing. And they were thrilled, you know, the fact that the education was going on in the schools. It was a lot of the work that they're looking forward to doing and wanting to do. And they said, you're already doing a lot of it. Let's partner together.
Mm-hmm. What are the challenges in working with schools, public schools in particular?
You know, I think that for the most part, if you're going for a district-wide approach, it tends to be a little slow-moving compared to, like Melissa said, we are a very entrepreneurial organization. We're fast-paced. We've had the luxury of we kind of see an issue, identify a need, and we come up with a solution, and we go out there and do it. And sometimes it takes just a little bit longer to get the necessary approvals through all of the different levels in a school district. But that being said, we here in Kansas City have a really solid group of school districts that work together, have strong leadership. They aren't afraid to try new things. And so I think we've seen some success in the districts that we are working in.
We've been discussing preventative health care programs that can help with child health problems and how medical data aids in that process. Our guests are Melissa Fraking, Executive Director of First Hand Foundation, and Anna Hens, a Program Manager also with First Hand Foundation. Thank you for coming to Central Standard today.
Thank
you.
And tune in tomorrow when we explore the foolish exploits of mankind through poetry with writer William Trowbridge. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with philosopher Alain de Botton. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.